Welcome all. Today we have the pleasure of Christine Spang joining us. Christine is CTO and co-founder of Nihilus, a tech company that provides APIs for email, calendar, and contact data. And we're in SoMa, San Francisco at the moment. As we've done previously, we'll be talking a little bit about how Christine got into coding, into programming, what her first experiences were, the trials and tribulations that you deal with on a regular basis, doing engineering, managing an engineering team. So for the audience that doesn't know you, do you mind introducing how you got into programming?
Sure. Also, like, thanks for coming by.
Oh, absolutely.
Nice to show you the office. It was only like when I got to high school that I, like, a bunch of things happened that helped me, like, refine my idea of, like, what I wanted to get into. So I went to, like, a pretty typical American public school. And, like, that school didn't have, like, any computing classes at all. I think you could take a keyboarding class if you wanted to. But that was, like, it was, like, learn to touch type.
Yeah.
Where they would, like, you know, put the box over the keyboard and, like, so you couldn't see the keys. So you couldn't, like, hunt and peck. But, like, we didn't have any computer classes, so, like, there was, like, no way for me to get involved in like, software computing at school. But kind of, like, my, like, hobby in my spare time, like, ended up being, like, playing around a lot on my parents' computer. Like, this was back in the days where, like, computers were still, like, these desktop towers, like, you know, this big from like, CompUSA or, like, whatever. I don't think Best Buy existed yet. It was, like, CompUSA and I don't remember what the other one was, but
you would get these magazines in the mail of all of their sales. I remember those.
Yeah, I think it was an HP computer that I got. Mm-hmm. Back when they still made, like, desktop machines. But I like, spent so much time on my parents' computer in my basement playing games that, like, eventually they got really annoyed and got me my own computer and put it in my room. Like, back in the day, or back in that time, like, gaming was not, like, or, like, at least the kind of gaming that I got into was, like, my parents also refused to get me or my siblings any sort of gaming console because they said that we would fight over them, which really just meant we spent all the time on the computer, and they never got to use their computer. But, I don't know, some strange logic.
Parenting.
But, you know, I was a teenager and I didn't have any money, so, like, I tried to, like, download games online and just, like, find whatever free stuff I could. And I really tried to find games that were, like, very unstructured. So that meant sometimes, like, playing, like, strategy games, like, Warcraft.
The original.
World of Warcraft didn't come till later, and I've never played it in my life. But the original Warcraft, and then, like, StarCraft and Age of Empires. But then I kept trying to, like, push the boundaries of, like wanting less structure to just, like, explore and not have as many rules, which eventually led me to, like, playing, like, kind of, like, RPGs. First, like, graphical RPGs, which had, like, a story and were kind of constrained. And then I discovered these things called MUDs, or multi-user dungeons or domains, depending on who you ask when, which were basically, like, text-based games that, like, people, like, built these text-based worlds that you could, like, explore and, like, you know, it would say, like, you're in a dungeon, on your left is, like, this thing, and, you know, you could, like, go from room to room. And some of these games got, like, pretty, like, complex. And there was, like a small subset of, like, really, really dedicated people who were, like, really into these games. So I started playing this, one of these games that was Lord of the Rings themed, because I was really into the Lord of the Rings in high school. This was like right about the time when the movies were coming out. But I had like read all the books and stuff like that. I got into this game, and I spent a lot of time playing it. And after like maybe like a year of playing it, so there's like a bunch of people that actually like had to like build and run the game. And like whenever people like left to go do other things with their life, they like tried to get new people to like get involved. And because I was like a really dedicated player, they reached out to me. So I started helping run the game, and there were like different flavors of administrators that would run this game. Some of them were called role-playing administrators, which is basically like you would come up with storylines and kind of like run plots and things and make things happen in the game, which would sometimes involve like building new areas in the game, so like creating these rooms and objects. But like one thing that you couldn't do if you were like a role-playing administrator was like kind of change the actual mechanics of like of how the game worked. And in order to do that, you had to like actually like learn to program in order to be able to like make modifications to the game itself.
Mm-hmm.
So because I was like working on this game, I like decided that I wanted to learn to program. And of course the game was written in C, which is like the worst possible language you could try to learn as your first language. So I started like trying to learn C, in order to be able to like work on this game. And, the game also would only run on Linux. And I have like a Windows PC at the time, because everything comes pre-installed with Windows. My uncle, who's a software engineer, I had like two different uncles, and one of them worked for Microsoft, and the other was like completely anti-Microsoft. The anti-Microsoft uncle had like I have very fond memories of playing funny Linux games like NetHack on his computers at his house.
So did he help you get set up to do development on the MUD games, the Lord of the Rings games you were working on?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't my uncle directly, but I have a twin brother, and my brother had, like, I don't even know the context for it was, but had gotten involved, or, like, gotten interested in running Linux through my uncle. I'm like, I don't know why my uncle used Debian, but my uncle used Debian, which is a flavor of Linux. And I remember my brother having a CD, or maybe three CDs or something like that, which had, like, Debian. They all have code names, and I think it was, like, Potato or maybe Sarge. They're all, like, named after Toy Story characters. But this was, like, I don't know.
Circa
2004? I think 2004. My brother helped me install Linux on my Windows PC, and after, like, I don't know, some hours or, like, a day or so, we managed to, like, install Linux on it without, like, bricking the Windows installation, which was a bit of a feat back in that day. And so I got Linux up and running, and I started learning C, and I, like, remember there's this, like, famous book about the C programming language called the K and R C book.
Mm-hmm.
And it, like, it's pretty straightforward up until you get to the chapter about pointers, and I just have this vivid memory of, like, rereading the chapter about pointers like three times, like trying to understand what the hell a pointer was. And I would say that, like, I was not that successful at learning C. Like, I got, like, okay at it, but I never made any, like, huge changes to this game. But as like, I don't know, I have this, like, habit or pattern of, like, I don't know, maybe just, like, following curiosity to, like, to like the extreme where like if I start doing something and I'm like really into it, I'll like eventually end up like in charge of it. So it's like I started playing the game, and then like a year later I was like, let me run the game. And then like I installed Debian, and I got curious, like how where does like this thing come from? Like, wait, what? It's built by volunteers from where? Everywhere. So I started reading this like blog aggregator that like aggregated the blogs of all of these contributors to Debian Linux, and through that I saw this blog post by a person named Hannah Wallach, and she wrote a blog post advertising this new group that she and another person had formed called Debian Women, which was a group to try to get more women involved in helping make Debian. Mm-hmm. So when I saw that, I was like, oh, that's cool. Like, they're trying to get people like me involved. And it was like a pretty powerful like call to action. So I like joined their IRC channel and started working on like random Debian packaging.
This was in like junior, senior year of high school? Or?
Yeah, so I think I would have been a junior at that point. Like kind of early junior year or something like that.
So while other people were maybe using AOL Instant Messenger, you were in IRC channels chatting about open source operating systems?
Kind of, yeah. Yeah, I did have an AOL screen name, but I don't remember that much about it. I remember more about IRC.
Not a whole lot of open source development happening on AOL Instant Messenger.
I was just really proud that I, for a while, had the username Christine on Freenode.
Nice.
Which just showed to prove like how few women there were on this IRC network. This was like 2005, and like no one's picked my first name. But I unfortunately, I think I lost it because they expired them after a while. Mm-hmm. And I like didn't log in for a long time, and they released my name. Mm-hmm. Now someone else has it.
So you got some programming and open source contribution experience under your belt before going mm-hmm. even on to college. But mm-hmm. once in college, you told me an interesting story about your first internship. So I think people would love to hear about what your first professional paid, mm-hmm. Getting paid to code experience was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like the major reason that I wanted to go to MIT as like my first choice school was because I had learned about like free and open source software through like working on Debian, mm-hmm. and actually probably wouldn't even have applied if I hadn't gotten like cheerleaded by Hannah, who was like, you can do it.
Yeah.
So I ended up going to MIT, and I never really like one thing that was like secret here, I never applied to a job until I was after college because of my connections from Debian, actually.
That's amazing.
Which is super cool. Especially since, like, I wouldn't say I was, like, really confident as, like a programmer or, like, even a person at the time. You know, I was, like, 17 years old and just starting out college. And it's, like, a lot of change and things going on right there. And it's, like, you know, you're, like, living on your own for the first time. But, like, it was really cool that someone had, like, heard of me by, like, reputation just because, like, I was involved in Debian, which is, I guess, makes you stand out amongst, like, a sea of incoming freshmen. They're like, oh, you know, she worked on, a Linux project. Mm-hmm. And so someone had, like, heard of me through the grapevine and came and, like, offered me a job at their company, which was this company called Best Practical, which was based in Somerville, which is this town right up the road from MIT. It's like 5 miles away or something like that. Mm-hmm. But this company was It was definitely like a non-traditional company. It was like maybe 10 people, but only like 5 of them were in like the Boston, Cambridge area. And then like the rest of them were like all over the world because like I feel like the first people that kind of proved that you could like have really effective like remote collaboration or like open source communities.
Oh, absolutely.
That blew my mind in high school that like how many volunteers? 1,000 volunteers from everywhere, like somehow managed to like release a working operating system like every 2 years. Yeah. And so it turns out that like some of those people like made companies that built software as well, in like a very different manner from like kind of a more like monolithic company like Microsoft or whatever. So I never even like considered going and like applying to like the big software companies because I actually had like a bit of a bad opinion of them just because like I didn't feel like they were really making the world a better place.
You had been effectively indoctrinated,
yeah,
by like, the open source community.
Yeah, it was like my first experience of kind of like working on and contributing to something that was like a really useful thing. And like, so I met all these interesting people and, you know, I was convinced that like free and open source software were superior. So it was really cool that like I got a job through this.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was also cool that like the job was very flexible about location. So like I spent 2 summers working for them, and both summers I actually spent living in Europe, which I definitely wouldn't have been able to do without that.
So their offices were in Somerville, but as a summer intern, they let you work from Europe?
I felt pretty lucky.
I think our audience should take note of the other upsides to being an active member of the open source communities, that you get to work for or with companies that have this type of attitude about working environment and caring about butts and seats type of output. So.
Yeah, I mean, like, people who have been involved in these kinds of communities, like, don't even think twice about, like the fact that it's possible to, like, collaborate in this manner. Like, companies like WordPress.com, like, they're distributed all over the world. And, like, I do, actually, like, having worked at a bunch of different companies at this point and, like, started a company, like, I have now experience with like different modes of collaboration, and you know, I think there is a time and place for like all being in the same place at the same time, but you know, there's also plenty of companies that like it doesn't really matter.
So after graduating MIT as an undergrad, you started a master's program in computer science, is that right? But I know your story has taken you down a number of startup routes since then.
Yeah, so at MIT, they have this thing called the MEng program, or Masters of Engineering, which you can only do this program if you were an MIT undergrad, and it's typically a year or a year and a half of, like, an add-on master's degree to your undergrad. There's, like, the only things you need to qualify for it are like a minimum GPA of whatever value, and then you have to like find an advisor and like a thesis project. When I was like just starting at MIT, my grades were not very good, but they got better over time because like the classes became more interesting, and there were like more things that like I was really excited about, because like in the beginning it's like a lot of core curriculum, like basic physics, math, differential equations, all that stuff. But like by my junior and senior year, I was taking stuff like Jerry Sussman's crazy scheme class.
Well, there are a couple of things that you've told me before about MIT that I found really interesting. Both things I had not known previously. One, which was, as a freshman, your classes are pass-fail. which is which can be a good thing or a bad thing depending on how you look at it.
Yeah, it's actually pass no record, which means they wipe it from your record if
even
you
better
fail, which it's like kind of good because it's like a little bit shocking to a lot of people because when they get to MIT, because like every one of these people was like in the top 1% of their high school, and then they like all get thrown together in the same room, and like the classes are way harder. So it's like there's an adjustment period, and I think that's a good thing.
Did you pass all your classes your freshman year?
No.
This is helpful for people to know.
Yeah. Like, yeah, no, I failed. When did I fail my first year? Well, I definitely. I'm trying to remember which class I failed my first semester. I can't remember, but my second semester I failed differential equations. Mm-hmm. And I almost failed freshman physics. But, like, part of that was, like, the adjustment, and part of that was also, like, the upperclassmen in my dorm would, like, joke around and be like, oh, you're on pass no record, you guys don't need to study. Which is really bad advice. It turns out you do need to study. And there's also, like, lots of tempting distractions when you're, like, living on your own for the first time.
Oh, for sure.
Like, also, like, MIT has this tradition of, like, people going and exploring on top of buildings and, like, playing pranks, which involves, like, staying up really late at night. And so... I wasn't necessarily, like, getting a lot of sleep all the time. And it turns out that sleep is very necessary for doing well in school. but I figured this out by, like, mid-sophomore year and kind of, like got my shit together. But it was definitely, like, a pretty rough transition. Like, I failed one class a semester for, like, 3 semesters.
Mm.
But, like, never managed to, like... Like, managed to keep it just above the line where they, like, start getting mad at you for it. And luckily, like, it didn't affect, like, my graduation rates or anything like that.
Well, the second thing that you told me about MIT that I hadn't known about before was how the graduate classes are easier than the undergrad classes in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like... Definitely amongst the undergrad population, at least in, like, EECS, people have the general sentiment that the graduate classes are easier than the undergraduate classes.
Yeah.
So, like, I had a few things going for me as, like, time went on. One, like, got through all the really boring core curriculum and started taking more, like, CS classes that was what I was really interested in. And also, like, junior and senior year, I started being able to take grad classes where I was interested in. So, like, probably my favorite class at all of MIT was the operating systems class, which was super cool. Like, every week you would do these labs, which weren't C. So I had a head start.
Yeah.
But you would effectively be building little parts of, like, an actual, like, very minimal operating system, which... It was really interesting, and, like, super satisfying. So I had a ton of fun in that class, and, like, that is what led me to, like, almost become a operating systems grad student and instead drop out of the grad program and work for my friend's operating systems Linux startup.
Yeah. Not many people can tell that story.
Yeah.
What was so compelling about that alternative path over finishing the graduate program?
Yeah. So, like I mentioned previously that I never, like, really applied to jobs while I was in school. And also something I didn't mention before was that when I was visiting MIT for, like, the kind of freshman preview weekend, I temporarily stayed with someone from the Debian project, and they, like, took me on a tour of their lab, and through that, I actually got my first job ever at that lab. So I ended up working at MIT for 3 months before the school year started.
Oh, nice.
Which is great because I really wanted to get out of my hometown. And so, like, I graduated from high school on a Saturday, and on Monday, my dad drove me to Cambridge and dropped me off in my, like, sublet apartment and was like, bye.
Nice.
So I got to, like, adjust a little bit beforehand and, like, get to know the area, and I think that was good. It was better than, like, bumming around my hometown for 3 months.
So one thing I realize I'm jumping a large portion of the timeline here, but I'm curious about is whether you use Debian today.
Yep, I do.
Is it used here at Nihilus? Do you guys use it on your servers?
We do. I keep telling people that if they want to switch to Ubuntu, it's totally okay with me, but they haven't. Like, we're in the midst of upgrading all of our servers from, like, the version of Debian that was current when we launched to, like, the now current version, which is, like, two major versions. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I don't care what it is. Like, you can use the latest version of Debian. You can use the latest version of Ubuntu. I just really don't want you to use Red Hat because I think that'll be a big learning curve for a lot of people here. But I don't know if they're just, like, passing deference or they actually don't care. But they're sticking to using Debian. I'm also one of only two people in the office who runs Linux on their laptop.
Speaking of learning curves, I kind of think of open source development as a pool. Like, when you say contributing to Debian, mm-hmm. in high school, I think of jumping in the deep end of the pool.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you could say you waded into the pool by getting into it initially through the motivation of contributing back to the mud games that you were playing at the time.
Yeah, it is interesting that like different flavors of Linux also have like reputations for like different levels of difficulty, and like if this is easy and this is hard, Debian's like here. So I was like, maybe like, of even if all Linux distros at the time were not that user friendly, like Debian was not the most user friendly.
So, for people getting into it in 2017, which is a good decade later, how can people wade into the pool like you did in terms of finding initial open source projects that they can get their toes into?
Yeah, that's a good question. I used to have a really good answer to this, and it was this organization called OpenHatch. I don't know if they're active these days.
They were Boston-based, is that right?
Yeah, openhatch.org. I'm not sure of the activity of the project right now, but like the whole point of the project was to like kind of find like bite-sized things for like new contributors to get involved in existing open source projects. But I would say like there's lots of like open source software out there, and like probably the best thing is to like find a project that you use and like go find their website, their like source code repo. They probably have some sort of chat room, and just kind of like show up. There was this like big renaissance in the last 10 years of like organizations and like software communities getting much better about like kind of writing down like the unsaid like tribal knowledge for like contributing. Which I think has made a big difference. Obviously it's like unevenly distributed, but I think things are in a lot better place than they were like 10 years ago.
Oh, for sure. Something you just said just kind of made my eyebrows raise, which was just kind of show up. And I think that's totally true. But B, it might be helpful for us to explicitly draw the line for our audience about how contributing and learning how to contribute to open source projects meant that you didn't have to search for a job. I mean, besides selfish reasons aside about career growth, open source, contributing to open source is a really great career move in general.
Also, like, when One thing I've learned over the last decade is that the amount of free time you have is, like, monotonically decreasing as you get older.
Absolutely.
So, like, the best time to contribute to open source is, like, high school, college, early career, because just kind of, like, responsibilities layer on, and, like, you don't have so much time.
Oh, certainly. I mean, since we were both in high school around the era you first picked up a C book, the the market share of server side applications has just swung so much from Microsoft to Linux. It's overwhelming.
I feel like I hit like a wave in a very lucky way. So we'll see what the next 10 years brings.
So speaking of the next 10 years, I think a large portion of our audience aren't familiar with Nihilus's product, although they might be using applications and software that are backed by your guys' product. Your guys' product is not unique in that you guys are open source, but you guys are kind of unique in which open source license you guys use to license the software that Nihilus builds. So for people who aren't familiar with what exactly Nihilus does or how your guys' license has an effect on your guys' business model, do you mind sharing for the layperson what exactly it is that Nihilus does?
Yeah, for sure. So the main product that Nihilus has is basically a really nice modern REST API that allows developers to build features into their applications that integrate with email and contacts and calendar. And there's different ways that you can explain this. Some folks who are listening to this have probably heard of things like the Gmail API. And you can kind of think of Nihilus as being like the Gmail API, but for like every email provider, and the same consistent API across all email providers. So like one thing that is tricky when kind of building email features into like a professional product is that there's like a lot of heterogeneity in the email ecosystem. There's like, you know, there's like the Gmail ecosystem, and then there's like the Microsoft ecosystem, and there's also like this like long tail of like hodgepodge IMAP servers. Making products that are compatible with all of those is really tricky. And the whole reason for Nihilus existing is to make that a lot easier, especially since email has been around for like longer than the web. So it's like 40 plus years at this point, and there have been like different new features that have been added over time, and that kind of just like layered on complexity. And Nihilus is kind of a fresh take in that we abstract over all of that complexity and make it so that developers can just work with kind of the sort of modern APIs that they're used to when they're learning to program these days.
So for any of our audience members that are raging at their phone's email app, whether iPhone or Android, or checking their emails on their laptop or whatever, Nihilus provides a service for building email apps that can be used by any customer, irrespective of whether they use Gmail or Yahoo or Hotmail, etc.
Yeah, like a lot of our customers are building like inline email features into some app that like is like a database for their customers or things like that, and they want to have like this really seamless experience where people are not juggling between like an email app where they're like sending emails and then like having to copy paste or like link them to kind of these databases. And like a lot of these databases are like storing metadata on people or organizations, and like they want to link to the communication that's happening. So Nihilus allows that to happen really easily. But you were asking about licensing. And I think one thing that's unique about how we went about launching the company was that we actually launched an open source repo before we even launched our product. And that was in 2014, summer of 2014. And so like the first press we ever got was like pressing was from like on GitHub switching the like private bit to public on our main source code repo, which was like all the code we had written to that time, which was really scary actually. And we were like kind of terrified to do it because I think there's like a little bit of like ego thing in there where like you're like worried that someone will like criticize your code and stuff like that. But
nobody did.
Well, we flipped the bit in January of 2014.
Okay.
And literally nothing happened. It turns out that like if you build it, no one will turn up unless you then spend a lot of time telling them about having built it. So we flipped the bit in January, and then for 6 months, like no one ever saw it pretty much because it was like one of like millions of repos on GitHub. But then in the summer, we did like a press release about kind of what we were building with trying to push email forward. And from there, like launched the first like actual version of the API product in the fall. The first thing we released was actually like our source code. And at that time, it was all of our source code. Like we were just directly committing to that repo like every day.
Yeah.
And there's a few things that you have to think about when thinking about licensing. So they're kind of like two different categories of source code licenses. And one is called like permissive licenses, and the others are what's a good term for like the GPL family? It's like they're basically like licenses that okay, so a permissive license means I release a source code, you can take it, modify it, like keep your copy of it private, even if you've made changes to it, you can do whatever you want pretty much. And then the other category is a family of licenses that are typically derivatives of this thing called the General Public License, which was created by the Free Software Foundation. And the key piece of this license is that if you take software licensed under the GPL or its derivatives, and you make changes to it, and you let someone use software that is based on this change version, you then have to release those changes to your users. And companies like the permissive license a lot more. For some pretty obvious reasons, in that like they don't want to have to, a lot of companies don't want to have to release their changes back because it restricts kind of their options for like what they can build, and what they like, how they can structure their own kind of like licensing and like how they build software.
And it makes them a less attractive software to resell. So
yeah,
this is a very key portion to why somebody can't come along and take Nihilus's AGPL licensed code.
Right. So we actually specifically chose the kind of more restrictive licensing because as a company, it grants us more protections, in that we, if, for example, someone wanted to like use our product or our code and make changes to it and not release those, we could still grant them a like commercial license to the code because we own the copyright on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's useful. It also kind of deters people from like just wholesale like stealing our code and then trying to replicate the service, because whatever changes they made to that code, they would also have to release. So like I definitely, you know, my roots are as like a total free software hippie, and I feel like over the last 10 years through like working at one startup that was like doing kind of open source things and starting a company that has contributed a lot to open source and also used a lot of open source, I've learned a lot more about kind of the fine line you have to walk just because of like the way like the world is structured. It's like pretty hard to build like a true open source business unless you're selling just like pure services, mm-hmm. which is like a harder business to build actually, because like software, you can ship it to a million people for like not that much more work than you would ship it to like 1,000 people. But mm-hmm. if you want to like scale like a consulting and services business, then like you essentially have to like train your workforce linearly for the number of customers you have. Mm-hmm. So like if you're building a business as a software company, you really need to like think hard about like what kind of company you want to be. And unfortunately it is the case that like, you know, if you release all of your code, like, and you like give it a permissive license, probably if you build something really valuable, like someone will like rip it off. So you'd have to think about those kinds of things. And so like we have this like AGPL version of our sync engine and API. But we did eventually start building some like proprietary parts to the service, which is like, you know, another thing that is all part of this balance of like, how do you build a sustainable business? And like, I'm definitely like not 100% happy with it, but I feel like it's a compromise due to like the way the world works.
Oh, for sure.
so we have some proprietary pieces, as well as the open source code at this point.
So for our audience that might be job seekers or might be interested potential Nihilist customers, I figure we should take a little bit of time to plug any roles you guys are hiring for, mm-hmm. or just getting your guys' message out there, mm-hmm. as an employer or as a salesperson.
mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I mean, we are hiring for a bunch of different roles right now, actually. We're generally just hiring for kind of generalist full stack software engineers to join the team. Not people that are like straight out of school, but people with a couple years of experience. We're also looking for someone to do developer success here. So that's like helping people use our APIs and like build the things that they're trying to build. Mm-hmm. And we're also looking for someone with some experience with like distributed systems or security, because you know, we are like growing the product pretty rapidly, and scaling is always challenging, and it's like really important to us to keep people's data secure. So like we it's important for us to keep investing in those areas.
So for the people in our audience who might not be eligible candidates for some of the roles that you just mentioned, mm-hmm. I know you guys contribute back to and in some ways support various mm-hmm. open source libraries that you yourself use. Mm-hmm. So if you guys are curious about getting your toes in the water with open source contributions, you should check out Nihilist's organization GitHub mm-hmm. page and check out some of the open source libraries they've got on there.
Yeah, I think that, like, we haven't been super great about kind of integrating with an external community in terms of, like, contributing, because it's really difficult, actually, to set up an open source project in a way that's, like, kind of giving people outside the company everything they need to be a good contributor. But it is a good code base that kind of shows, it's, like, a great example of, like, a production-level code base that, it's written in Python, so you know, like part of becoming like a really good engineer is like reading as much code as you write, hopefully reading more code than you write. So I definitely recommend like checking out the code base and, you know, like trying to run it yourself. We also did build some like Python performance instrumentation tools, which we have a blog post about. We have a few more interesting blog posts about like how we've like scaled our database and stuff like that, which would be good things.
Oh, agreed.
For folks interested in production systems.
We'll absolutely link those in the video notes and on the transcript. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, this has been tremendous. thanks for joining us, Fang.
For sure.
We'll talk again very soon.
Appreciate the invitation.
Absolutely. Cool.